here, but it got me up. Now, get rid of the wreckage on my back. The emergency release still worked, sort of. I hauled myself clear. The sunjet caught in the frame and would not tug loose on the tether line. I yanked at it for a senseless moment, then unseamed the tether instead, and bent to free the weapon from the other side.
All right, Ach,
Carrera's voice, trampled out by the interference from the interior structure.
If that ain't on it.
He was coming in after me. The sunjet stuck.
Leave it.
And fight him with a pistol? In Paul alloy? Weapons are an extension, screamed an exasperated Virginia Vidara in my head. You are the killer and destroyer. You are whole, with or without them. Leave it. Okay, Virginia, I sniggered a little. Whatever you say. I lurched away from the lintel-braced exit from the bay, drawing the interface pistol from its pouch. Wedge equipment was crated and stacked across the bay. The locator beacon, dumped unceremoniously, still powered at standby, the way Carrera had presumably dumped it. A nearby crate cracked open, sections of a disassembled Phillips launcher protruding. Haste written into the details of the scene, but it was a soldierly haste. Controlled speed. Combat competence. A man at his trade. Carrera was in his element. Get the fuck out of here, Tuck. Into the next chamber. Martian machines stirred, bristled, and then sloped sullenly away from me, muttering to themselves. I limped past them, following the painted arrows. No, don't fucking follow the arrows. I ducked left at the next opportunity and plunged along a corridor the expedition had not taken before. A machine snuffled after me a few paces, then went back. I thought I heard the sound of motion behind and above me. I jerked glance up into the shadowed space overhead. Ludicrous. Get a grip, Tuck. It's the meth. You did too much, and now you're hallucinating. More chambers. Intersecting curves, one into another, and always the space above. I stopped myself rigidly from looking up. The pain from the grenade shards in my leg and shoulder was beginning to seep up through the chemical armor of the tetrameth, waking echoes in my ruined left hand and the shattered joint in my right elbow. The furious energy I'd felt earlier had decayed to a jumpy sense of speed and vibrating riffs of inexplicable amusement that threatened to emerge as giggling. In that state, I backed through into a tight, closed chamber, turned about, and came face to face with my last Martian. This time, the mummified wing membranes were folded down around the skeletal frame, and the whole thing was crouched on a low roost bar. The long skull drooped forward over the chest, hiding the light gland. The eyes were closed. It lifted its beak and looked up at me. No, it fucking didn't. I shook my head, crept closer to the corpse, and stared at it. From somewhere, an impulse arose to caress the long bone ridge on the back of the skull. I'll just sit here for a while, I promised, stifling another giggle. Quietly, just a couple of hours. That's all I need. I lowered myself to the floor on my uninjured arm, leaned against the sloping wall behind us, clutching the interface gun like a charm. My body was a warm, twisting together of limp ropes inside the cage of the mob suit, a faintly quivering assemblage of soft tissue, with no more will to animate its exoskeleton. My gaze slipped up into the gloomy space at the top of the chamber, and for a while I thought I saw pale wings beating there, trying to escape the imprisoning curve. At some point, though, I spotted the fact that they were in my head, because I could feel their paper-thin texture brushing around the inner surface of my skull, scraping minutely but painfully at the insides of my eyeballs, and obscuring my vision by degrees, pale to dark, pale to dark, pale to dark, to dark, to dark, and a thin, rising whine, like grief. Wake up, Kovach. The voice was gentle, and there was something nudging at my hand. My eyes seemed to be gummed shut. I lifted one arm, and my hand bumped off the smooth curve of the faceplate. Wake up! Less gentle now. A tiny jag of adrenaline went eeling along my nerves at the change in tone. I blinked hard and focused. The Martian was still there. No shit talk. But my view of the corpse was blocked by the figure in the polyalloy suit that stood a safe 3 or 4 meters out of reach. Sunjet carried at a wary angle. The nudging at my hand recommenced. I tipped the helmet and looked down. One of the Martian machines was stroking at my glove with an array of delicate-looking receptors. I shoved it away, and it backed up, chittering a couple of places, then came sniffing back, undeterred. Carrera laughed. It rang too loud on the helmet receiver. I felt as if the fluttering wings had somehow hollowed out my head so that my whole skull wasn't much less delicate than the mummified remains I was sharing the chamber with.
"That's right. Fucking thing led me to you. Can you believe that? Really helpful, little beastie."
At that point, I laughed, too. It seemed the only thing appropriate to the moment. The Wedge commander joined in. He held up the interface gun in his left hand and laughed louder.
"Were you gonna kill me with this?"
"Doubt it." We both stopped laughing. His faceplate hinged up, and he looked down at me out of a face gone slightly haggard around the eyes. I guessed even the short time he'd spent tracking me through the Martian architecture hadn't been a lot of fun. I flexed my palm once, on the off chance that LaMonaco's gun might not have been personally coded, that any Wedge palm plate might be able to call it. Carrera caught the move and shook his head. He tossed the weapon into my lap.
"Unload it anyway. Hold on to it if you like. Some men go better that way, holding a gun tight. Seems to help at the end. Substitute for something, I guess. Mother's hand, your dick. You want to stand up to die?"
"No," I said softly.
"Open your helmet."
"What for?"
"Just giving you the option."
"Isaac." I cleared my throat of what felt like a web of rusted wire. Words scraped through. It seemed suddenly very important to say them.
"Isaac, I'm sorry." "You will be."
It flared through me like tears up behind my eyes, like the wolf-weeping loss that LaMonaco's and Quack's deaths had brought up through my throat.
"Good," he said simply. "But a little late."
"Have you seen what's behind you, Isaac?"
"Yeah, impressive, but very dead. No ghosts that I've seen."
He waited.
"Do you have anything else to say?"
I shook my head. He raised the sunjet.
"This is for my murdered men," he said.
"Look at the fucking thing," I screamed.
Every increment of envoy intonation pushed into it. And for just a fraction of a second, his head shifted. I came up off the floor, flexing in the mob suit, hurling the interface gun into the space below his hinged-up faceplate, and diving at him low. Miserly shavings of luck, a tetrameth crash, and my fading grip on envoy combat poise. It was all I had left, and I took it all across the space between us, teeth bared. When the sunjet crackled, it hit where I'd been. Maybe it was the shouted distraction, shifting his focus. Maybe the gun hurtling toward his face. Maybe just this same tired general sense that it was all over. He staggered backward as I hit him, and I trapped the sunjet between our bodies. He slid into a combat judo block that would have thrown an unarmored man off his hip. I hung on with the stolen strength of LaMonaco's suit. Another 2 stumbling backsteps, and we both smashed into the mummified Martian corpse together. The frame tipped and collapsed. We tumbled over it like clowns, staggering to get up as we slipped. The corpse disintegrated. Powder burst of pale orange in the air around us.
"I'm sorry." "You will be, if the skin crumbles."
Face plate up, panting. Carrera must have sucked in a lungful of the stuff. More settled on his eyes and the exposed skin of his face. The first yell as he felt it eating in. Then the screams. He staggered away from me, sunjet clattering to the deck, hands up and scrubbing at his face. Probably it only ground the stuff harder into the tissue it was dissolving. A deep-throated shrieking poured out of him, and a pale red froth began to foam through between his fingers and over his hands. Then the powder must have eaten through some part of his vocal cords, because the screams collapsed into a sound like a faltering drainage system. He hit the floor making that sound, gripping at his face as if he could somehow hold it in place and bubbling up thick gouts of blood and tissue from his corroded lungs. By the time I got to the sunjet and came back to stand over him with it, he was drowning in his own blood. Beneath the pall alloy, his body quivered as it went into shock. I'm sorry. I placed the barrel of the weapon on the hands that masked his melting face and pulled the trigger. Chapter 42. When I finished telling it, Roespinawegi clasped his hands together in a gesture that made him look almost like the child he wasn't.
"That's wonderful," he breathed. "The stuff of epics."
"Stop that," I told him.
"No, really. We're such a young culture here. Barely a century of planetary history. We need this sort of thing."
"Well," I shrugged, and reached for the bottle on the table. Shelved pain twinged in the broken elbow joint. "You can have the rights. Go sell it to the Lapine group. Maybe they'll make a construct opera out of the fucking thing."
"You may laugh."
There was a bright entrepreneurial gleam kindling in Roespinawegi's eyes.
"But there's a market for this homegrown stuff. Practically everything we've got here is imported from Latimer, and how long can you live on someone else's dreams?"
I poured my glass half full of whiskey again. "Kemp manages."
"Oh, that's politics, Takashi. Not the same thing. Mishmashed neo-quellist sentiment and old-time commun..."
He snapped his fingers.
"Come on, you're from Harlan's world. What's that stuff called?"
"Communitarianism."
"Yes, that."
He shook his head sagely.
"That stuff isn't going to stand the test of time like a good heroic tale. Planned production, social equality like some sort of bloody grade school construct. Who'd bite into that for somebody's sake? Where's the savor? Where's the blood and adrenaline?"
I sipped the whiskey and stared out across the warehouse roofs of Dig 27 to where the dighead's angular limbs stood steeped in the glow of sunset. Recent rumor, half jammed and scrambled as it unreeled on illicitly tuned screens, said the war was heating up in the equatorial west. Some counterblow of Kemp's that the cartel hadn't allowed for. Pity they didn't have Carrera around anymore to do their thinking for them. I shivered a little as the whiskey went down. It bit well enough, but in a polite, smoothly educated way. This wasn't the Sauberville blend I'd killed with Luke Dupre a subjective lifetime ago, last week. Somehow I couldn't imagine someone like Roespinawegi giving that one house room. "Plenty of blood out there at the moment," I observed.
"Yes, now there is, but that's the revolution. Think about afterward. Suppose Kemp won this ridiculous war and implemented this voting thing. What do you think would happen next? I'll tell you."
"Thought you would."
"In less than a year, he'd be signing the same contracts with the cartel for the same wealth-making dynamic, and if he didn't, his own people would, vote him out of Indigo City, and then do it for him."
"He doesn't strike me as the sort to go quietly."
"Yes, that's the problem with voting,"
Roespinawegi said judiciously.
"Apparently. Did you ever actually meet him?"
"Kemp? Yeah, a few times."
"And what was he like?"
"He was like Isaac. He was like Hand. He was like all of them. Same intensity, same goddamn fucking conviction that he was right. Just a different dream of what he was right about." "Tall," I said. "He was tall."
"Ah, well, yes, he would be."
I turned to look at the boy beside me. "Doesn't it worry you, Djoko? What's going to happen if the Kempists fight their way through this far?" He grinned.
"I doubt their political assessors are any different from the cartels. Everyone has appetites. And besides, with what you've given me, I think I have bargain capital enough to go up against old Top Hat himself and buy back my much-mortgaged soul."
His look sharpened.
"Allowing that we have dismantled all your dead-hand data launch security, that is."
"Relax. I told you, I only set up the five. Just enough so that Mandrake could find a few if it sniffed around. So it'd know they were really out there. It was all we had time for."
Hmm.
Roespinoegi rolled whiskey around on the base of his glass. The judicious tone in the young voice was incongruous.
Personally, I think you were crazy to take the risk with so few. What if Mandrake had flushed them all out?
I shrugged. What if? Han could never risk assuming he'd found all of them. Too much at stake. It was safer to let the money go. Essence of any good bluff.
Yes, well, you're the envoy.
He prodded at the slim, hand-sized slab of wedge technology, where it lay on the table between us.
And you're quite sure Mandrake has no way to recognize this broadcast?
Trust me. Just the words brought a grin to my lips. State-of-the-art military cloaking system. Without that little box there, transmission's indistinguishable from star static. For Mandrake, for anyone. You are the proud and undisputed owner of one Martian starship. Strictly limited edition. Roespinoegi stowed the remote and held up his hands.
All right, enough. We've got an agreement. Don't beat me over the head with it. A good salesman knows when to stop selling.
You just better not be fucking with me, I said amiably.
I'm a man of my word, Takashi. Day after tomorrow at the latest. The best that money can buy,
he sniffed.
In landfall, at any rate.
And a technician to fit it properly. A real technician, not some cut-rate, virtually qualified geek.
That's a strange attitude for someone planning to spend the next decade in a virtuality. I have a virtual degree myself, you know. Business administration. 36 virtually experienced case histories. Much better than trying to do it in the real world.
Figure of speech. A good technician. Don't go cutting corners on me.
Well, if you don't trust me, he said huffily, why don't you ask your young pilot friend to do it for you?
She'll be watching, and she knows enough to spot a fuck-up.
I'm sure she does. She seems very competent.
I felt my mouth curve at the understatement. Unfamiliar controls, a wedge-coated lockout that kept trying to come back online with every maneuver, and terminal radiation poisoning. Amelie Vongsavath wrote it all out without much more than the odd gritted curse, and took the battle wagon from Dangrek to Dig 27 in a little over 15 minutes. Yes, she is.
You know, Roespinoegi chuckled, last night I thought my time was finally up when I saw the wedge flashes on that monster. Never occurred to me a wedge transport could be hijacked.
I shivered again. Yeah, wasn't easy. We sat at the little table for a while, watching the sunlight slide down the support struts of the dighead. In the street, running alongside Roespinoegi's warehouse, there were children playing some kind of game that involved a lot of running and shouting. Their laughter drifted up to the roof patio like wood smoke from someone else's beach barbecue.
Did you give it a name?
Roespinoegi wondered finally.
This starship?
No, there wasn't really that kind of time.
So it seems. Well, now that there is, any ideas?
I shrugged. The Wardani?
Ah!
He looked at me shrewdly.
And would she like that?
I picked up my glass and drained it. How the fuck would I know? She'd barely spoken to me since I crawled back through the gate. Killing Lamont seemed to have put me over some kind of final line for her. Either that, or watching me stalk mechanically up and down in the mob suit, inflicting real death on the 100-odd wedge corpses that still littered the beach. She shut the gate down with a face that held less expression than a synthetic sleeve knockoff, followed Vongsavath and myself into the belly of the Anjan Chandra's virtue like a mandroid, and when we got to Roespinoegi's place, she locked herself in her room and didn't come out. I didn't feel much like pushing the point. Too tired for the conversation we needed to have. Not wholly convinced we even needed to have it anymore. And in any case, I told myself, until Roespinoegi was sold, I had other things to worry about. Roespinoegi was sold. The next morning, I was woken late by the sound of the tech crew contractors arriving from landfall in a badly landed air cruiser. Mildly hung over with the whiskey and Roespinoegi's powerful black-market anti-rad painkiller cocktails, I got up and went down to meet them. Young, slick, and probably very good at what they did,
They both irritated me on sight. We went through some introductory skirmishing under Ruespin Oegi's indulgent eye, but I was clearly losing my ability to instill fear. Their demeanor never made it out of what's with the sick dude in the suit. In the end, I gave up and led them out to the battle wagon, where Vong Savath was already waiting, arms folded, at the entry hatch and looking grimly possessive. The techs dropped their swagger as soon as they saw her.
"It's cool," she said to me when I tried to follow them inside. "Why don't you go talk to Tanya? I think she's got some stuff she needs to say."
"To me?" The pilot shrugged impatiently.
"To someone. And it looks like you're elected. She won't talk to me."
"Is she still in her room?"
"She went out."
Vong Savath waved an arm vaguely at the clutter of buildings that constituted Dig 27's town center.
"Go. I'll watch these guys."
I found her half an hour later, standing in the street on the upper levels of the town and staring at the facade in front of her. There was a small piece of Martian architecture trapped there, perfectly preserved blued facades now cemented in on either side to form part of a containing wall and an arch. Someone had painted over the glyph-brushed surface in thick aluminum paint. Filtration reclaim. Beyond the arch, the unpaved ground was littered with dismembered machinery gathered approximately into lines across the arid earth, like some unlikely sprouting crop. A couple of coveralled figures were rooting around aimlessly, up and down the rows. She looked around as I approached, gaunt-faced, gnawed at with some anger she couldn't let go of.
"You following me?"
"Not intentionally," I lied. "Sleep well?" She shook her head.
"I can still hear Suchiati."
"Yeah." When the silence had stretched too much, I nodded at the arch. "You going in here?"
"Are you fucking..." "No. I only stopped to..."
She gestured helplessly at the paint-daubed Martian alloy. I peered at the glyphs. "Instructions for a faster-than-light drive, right?" She almost smiled.
"No."
She reached out to run her fingers along the form of one of the glyphs.
"It's a schooling's creed. Sort of a cross between a poem and a set of safety instructions for fledglings. Parts of it are equations, probably for lift and drag. It's sort of a graffito as well. It says..."
She stopped, shook her head again.
"There's no way to say what it says. But it promises. Well, enlightenment, a sense of eternity, from dreaming the use of your wings before you can actually fly, and take a good shit before you go up in a populated area."
"You're winding me up. It doesn't say that."
"It does. All tied to the same equation sequence, too."
She turned away.
"They were good at integrating things. Not much compartmentalization in the Martian psyche, from what we can tell."
The demonstration of knowledge seemed to have exhausted her. Her head drooped.
"I was going to the dighead,"
she said.
"That cafe Ruespin Oegi showed us last time. I don't think my stomach will hold anything down, but..."
"Sure. I'll walk with you." She looked at the mob suit, now rather obvious under the clothes the Dig 27 entrepreneur had lent me.
"Maybe I should get one of those."
"Barely worth it for the time we've got left." We plodded up the slope.
"You sure this is going to come off?"
she asked. "What? Selling the biggest archaeological coup of the past 500 years to Ruespin Oegi for the price of a virtuality box and a black market launch slot? What do you think?"
"I think he's a fucking merchant, and you can't trust him any farther than Hand."
"Tanya," I said gently, "it wasn't Hand who sold us out to the Wedge. Ruespin Oegi's getting the deal of the millennium, and he knows it. He's solid on this one, believe me."
"Well, you're the envoy."
The cafe was pretty much as I remembered it, a forlorn-looking herd of molded chairs and tables gathered in the shade cast by the massive stanchions and struts of the dighead frame. A hollow menu fluoresced weakly overhead, and a muted Lapinet playlist seeped into the air from speakers hung on the structure. Martian artifacts stood about the place in no particular pattern that I could discern. We were the only customers. A terminally bored waiter sloped out of hiding somewhere and stood at our table looking resentful. I glanced up at the menu, then back at Ordani. She shook her head.
Just water,
she said.
And cigarettes, if you've got them.
Side sevens or will to victory. She grimaced.
Side sevens.
The waiter looked at me, obviously hoping I wasn't going to spoil his day and order some food. Got coffee? He nodded. Bring me some. Black, with whiskey in it. He trudged away. I raised an eyebrow at Wardani behind his back.
Leave him alone. Can't be much fun working here.
Could be worse. He could be a conscript. Besides, I gestured around me at the artifacts. Look at the decor. What more could you want? A wan smile.
Takashi.
She hunched forward over the table.
When you get the virtual gear installed, I'm not going with you.
I nodded. Been expecting this.
I'm sorry.
What are you apologizing to me for?
You've done a lot for me in the last couple of months. You got me out of the camp.
We pulled you out of the camp because we needed you, remember?
I was angry when I said that. Not with you, but...
Yeah, with me. Me, Schneider, the whole fucking world in a uniform. I shrugged. I don't blame you. And you were right. We got you out because we needed you. You don't owe me anything. She studied her hands where they lay in her lap.
You helped put me back together again, Takashi. I didn't want to admit it to myself at the time, but that envoy recovery shit works. I'm getting better. Slowly. But it's off that base.
That's good. I hesitated, then made myself say it. Fact remains, I did it because I needed you. Part of the rescue package. There was no point in getting you out of the camp if we left half your soul behind. Her mouth twitched.
Soul?
Sorry. Vigorous speech. Too much time hanging around hand. Look, I got no problem with you bailing out. I'm kind of curious to know why, is all. The waiter toiled back into view at that point, and we quieted. He laid out the drinks and the cigarettes. Tanya Wardani slit the pack and offered me one across the table. I shook my head. I'm quitting. Those things will kill you. She laughed almost silently and fed herself one from the pack. Smoke curled up as she touched the ignition patch. The waiter left. I sipped at my whiskey coffee and was pleasantly surprised. Wardani plumed smoke up into the dighead frame space.
Why am I staying?
Why are you staying? She looked at the tabletop.
I can't leave now, Takashi. Sooner or later, what we found out there is going to get into the public domain. They'll open the gate again. Or take an IP cruiser out there. Or both.
Yeah, sooner or later. But right now there's a war on the way.
I can wait.
Why not wait on Latimer? It's a lot safer there.
I can't. You said yourself... Transit time in the Chandra has got to be 11 years minimum. That's full acceleration, without any course correction Amelie might have to do. Who knows what's going to happen back here in the next 11 years?
The war might end, for one thing.
The war might be over next year, Takashi. Then Roespin Oeji's going to move on his investment. And when that happens, I want to be here.
10 minutes ago, you couldn't trust him any more than hand. Now you want to work for him? She looked at her hands again.
We talked about it this morning. He's willing to hide me until things have calmed down. Get me a new sleeve.
She smiled a little sheepishly.
Guildmasters are thin on the ground since the war kicked in. I guess I'm part of his investment.
Guess so. Even while the words were coming out of my mouth, I couldn't work out why I was trying so hard to talk her out of this. You know that won't help much if the Wedge come looking for you, don't you?
Is that likely?
It could ha- I sighed. No, not really. Carrera's probably backed up somewhere in a sneak station, but it'll be a while before they realize that he's dead. While longer before they sort the authorization to sleeve the backup copy. And even if he does get out to Dangrik, there's nobody left to tell him what happened there. She shivered and looked away. It had to be done, Tanya. We had to cover our traces. You, of all people, should know that.
What?
Her eyes flicked back in my direction.
I said, "You of all people should know that." I kept her gaze.
"It's what you did last time around, isn't it?"
She looked away again, convulsively.
Smoke curled up off her cigarette and was snatched away by the breeze. I leaned into the silence between us.
"It doesn't much matter now. You don't have the skills to sink us between here and Latimer, and once we're there, you'll never see me again.
Would never have seen me again. And now you're not coming with us. But like I said, I'm curious."
She moved her arm as if it weren't connected to her, drew on the cigarette, exhaled mechanically. Her eyes were fixed on something I couldn't see from where I was sitting.
"How long have you known?"
"Known?" I thought about it. "Honestly, I think I've known from the day we pulled you out of the camp. Nothing I could lock down, but I knew there was a problem. Someone tried to bust you out before we came. The camp commandant let that slip in between fits of drooling."
"Sounds unusually animated for him."
She drew more smoke, hissed it out between her teeth.
"Yeah, well. Then, of course, there were your friends down on the wreck deck at Mandrake. Now that one I really should have spotted on the launch pad. I mean, it's only the oldest horse trick in the book. Lead the mark up a darkened alley by his dick and hand him over to your pimp."
She flinched. I forced a grin. "Sorry. Figure of speech. I just feel kind of stupid. Tell me, was that gun to your head stuff just tinsel, or were they serious?"
"I don't know."
She shook her head.
"They were Revolutionary Guard cadres. Kemp's hard men. They took out Deng when he came sniffing around after them. Really dead. Stack torched and bodies sold off for spares. They told me that while we were waiting for you. Maybe to scare me, I don't know. They probably would have shot me sooner than let me go again."
"Yeah, they convinced the fuck out of me as well. But you still called them in, didn't you?"
"Yes."
She said it to herself, as if discovering the truth for the first time.
"I did."
"Care to tell me why?" She made a tiny motion, something that might have been her head shaking, or just a shiver.
"Okay. Want to tell me how?"
She got herself back together, looked at me.
"Coded signal. I set it up while you and Jan were out casing Mandrake. Told them to wait on my signal. Then placed a call from my room in the tower when I was sure we were definitely going to Dangrek."
A smile crossed her face, but her voice could have been a machine's.
"I ordered underwear. From a catalog. Locational code in the numbers. Basic stuff."
I nodded. "Were you always a Kempist?" She shifted impatiently.
"I'm not from here, Kovach. I don't have any political... I don't have any right to a political stance here."
She shot me an angry look.
"But for Christ's sake, Kovach, it's their fucking planet, isn't it?"
"That sounds pretty much like a political stance to me."
"Yeah. Must be really nice not to have any beliefs."
She smoked some more, and I saw that her hand was trembling slightly.
"I envy you, your smug, sanctimonious fucking detachment."
"Well, it's not hard to come by, Tanya." I tried to curb the defensiveness in my voice. "Try working local military advisor to Joshua Kemp while Indigo City comes apart and civil riots around you. Remember those cuddly little inhib systems Carrera unloaded on us? First time I saw those in use on Sanction 4, Kemp's guardsmen were using them on protesting artifact merchants in Indigo City a year before the war kicked in. Maxed up, continuous discharge, no mercy for the exploitative classes. You get pretty detached after the first few street cleanups."
"So you changed sides?"
It was the same scorn I'd heard in her voice that night in the bar, the night she drove Schneider away. "Well, not immediately. I thought about assassinating Kemp for a while, but it didn't seem worth it. Some family member would have stepped in, some fucking cadre, and by then the war was looking pretty inevitable anyway. And like Quell says, these things need to run their hormonal course."
"Is that how you survive it?"
she whispered. "Tanya, I have been trying to leave ever since."
"I..."
she shuddered.
"I've watched you, Kovach. I watched you in landfall, in that firefight at the promoter's offices in the Mandrake Tower, the beach at Dangrek with your own men. I envied you what you have, how you live with yourself.
I took brief refuge in my whiskey coffee. She didn't seem to notice.
I can't.
A helpless, fending gesture.
I can't get them out of my head. Dasanapangsakul, Arabo, the rest of them. Most of them I didn't even see die, but they keep...
She swallowed hard.
How did you know?
You want to give me a cigarette now? She handed over the pack wordlessly. I busied myself with lighting and inhaling, to no noticeable benefit. My system was so bombed on damage and Roespinoegi's drugs, I would have been amazed if there had been. It was the thin comfort of habit, not much more. Envoy intuition doesn't work like that, I said slowly. Like I said, I knew something was wrong. I just didn't want to take it on board. You make a good impression, Tani Wardani. At some level, I didn't want to believe it was you. Even when you sabotaged the hold, she started.
Feng Savat said...
Yeah, I know. She still thinks it was Schneider. I haven't told her any different. I was pretty much convinced it was Schneider myself after he ran out on us. Like I said, I didn't want to think it might be you. When the Schneider angle showed up, I went after it like a heat seeker. There was a moment in the docking bay when I worked him out. You know what I felt? I was relieved. I had my solution, and I didn't have to think about who else might be involved anymore. So much for detachment, huh? She said nothing. But there were a whole stack of reasons why Schneider couldn't be the whole story. And the envoy conditioning just went on racking them up till there was too much to ignore anymore.
Such as?
Such as this. I reached into a pocket and shook out a portable data stack. The membrane settled on the table, and motes of light evolved in the projected data coil. Clean that space off for me. She looked at me curiously, then leaned forward and lobbed the display motes up to the top left-hand corner of the coil. The gesture echoed back in my head, the hours of watching her work in the screens of her two monitors. I nodded and smiled. Interesting habit. Most of us flattened down to the surface. More final. More satisfying, I guess. But you're different. You tidy upward.
Wysinski. It's his.
That where you picked it up?
I don't know.
She shrugged.
Probably.
You're not Wysinski, are you? It startled a short laugh out of her.
No, I'm not. I worked with him at Bradbury and on Nkrumah's land, but I'm half his age. Why would you think something like that?
Nothing. Just crossed my mind. You know, that cybersex virtuality. There was a lot of male tendency in what you did to yourself. Just wondered, you know, who'd know better how to live up to male fantasy than a man? She smiled at me.
Wrong, Takashi. Wrong way around. Who'd know better how to live up to male fantasy than a woman?
For a moment, something warm sparked between us, already fading as it came into being. Her smile washed away.
So, you were saying?
I pointed at the data coil. That's the pattern you leave after shutdown. That's the pattern you left in the cabin data coil on board the trawler. Presumably after you slammed the gate on Dasanapangsakul and his colleagues, after you took out the two on the trawler and dumped them in the nets. I saw it the morning after the party. Didn't notice at the time, but like I said, that's envoys for you. Just go on acquiring little scraps of data until it means something. She was staring intently at the data coil, but I still spotted the tremor go through her when I said Dasanapangsakul's name. There were other scraps once I started to look. The corrosion grenades in the hold. Sure, it took Schneider to shut down the onboard monitors on the Nagini, but you were fucking him. Old flame, in fact. I don't suppose you had any harder time talking him into it than you did in getting me down to the wreck deck at Mandrake. It didn't fit at first because you were pushing so hard to get the claim buoy aboard. Why go to the trouble of trying to put the buoys out of commission in the first place, then work so hard to get the remaining one placed? She nodded jerkily. Most of her was still dealing with Dasanapangsakul. I was talking into a vacuum. It kept me from thinking too much. Didn't make sense, that is, until I thought about what else had been put out of commission. Not the buoys. The ID&A sets. You'd trash them all. Because that way, no one was going to be able to put Dasanapang Sakul and the rest into virtual and find out what had happened to them. Of course, eventually, we'd get them back to landfall and find out. But then, you didn't plan for us to make it back, did you? That got her back to me. A haggard stare across wreathed smoke. You know when I worked most of this out? I sucked in my own smoke hard. On the swim back to the gate. See, I was pretty much convinced it would be closed by the time I got there. Wasn't quite sure why I thought that at first, but it sort of fell into place. They'd gone through the gate, and the gate had closed on them. Why would that happen? And how did poor old Dasanapang Sakul end up on the wrong side wearing a T-shirt? Then I remembered the waterfall. She blinked.
The waterfall?
Yeah. Any normal human being, post-coital, would have shoved me in the back into that pool and then laughed. We both would have. Instead, you started crying. I examined the end of my cigarette as if it interested me. You stood at the gate with Dasanapang Sakul and you pushed him through, and then you slammed it shut. It doesn't take 2 hours to shut that gate, does it, Tanya?
No,
she whispered. Were you already thinking you might have to do the same thing to me? Then, at the waterfall?
She
shook her head.
Don't know.
How did you kill the two on the trawler?
Stunner. Then the nets. They drowned before they woke up.
She cleared her throat.
I pulled them up again later. I was going to, I don't know, bury them somewhere. Maybe even wait a few days and drag them to the gate. Try to open it so I could dump them through as well. I panicked. I couldn't stand to be there, wondering if Araboo and Wang might find some way to open the gate again before their air ran out.
She looked at me defiantly.
I didn't really believe that. I'm an archaeologue. I know how...
She was silent for a few moments.
I couldn't even have opened it again myself in time to save them. It was just... the gate. What it meant. Sitting there on the trawler, knowing they were just the other side of that. Thing. Suffocating. Millions of kilometers away in the sky above my head and still right there in the cavern. So close. Like something huge waiting for me.
I nodded. Back on the beach at Dangrik, I told Wardani and Vongsavath about the corpses I'd found sealed in the substance of the Martian vessel, while Carrera and I hunted each other across the hull. But I never told either of them about my last half hour inside the ship. The things I'd seen and heard as I stumbled back out to the echoing desolation of the docking bay with Carrera's impeller frame on my shoulders. The things I'd felt swimming beside me all the way back to the gate. After a while, my vision had narrowed down to that faint blur of light orbiting out in the blackness, and I didn't want to look around for fear of what I might see, what might be hunched there, offering me its taloned hand. I just dived for the light, scarcely able to believe it was still there, terrified that at any moment it would slam shut and leave me locked out in the dark. Tetrameth hallucination, I told myself later. And that was just going to have to do. So why didn't you take the trawler? She shook her head again and stubbed out her cigarette.
I panicked. I was cutting the stacks out of the two in the nets, and I just...
She shivered.
It was like something was staring at me. I dumped them back in the water, threw the stacks out to sea as far as I could. Then I just ran away. Didn't even try to blow the cavern or cover my tracks. Walked all the way into Sauberville.
Her voice changed in some way I couldn't define.
I got a ride with this guy in a ground car the last couple of clicks. Young guy with a couple of kids he was bringing back from a grav gliding trip. I guess they're all dead now.
Yes.
Sauberville wasn't far enough. I ran south. I was in the Butkinari hinterlands when the Protectorate signed the accords. Cartel forces picked me up from a refugee column, dumped me in the camp with the rest of them. At the time, it seemed almost like justice.
She fumbled out a fresh cigarette and fitted it in her mouth. Her gaze slanted my way.
That make you laugh?
No. I drained my coffee. Point of interest, though. What were you doing around Boot Canary? Why not head back for Indigo City, you being a Kempist sympathizer and all? She grimaced.
I don't think the Kempists would have been pleased to see me, Takashi. I just killed their entire expedition. Would have been a little hard to explain.
Kempists?
Yeah.
There was a gritted amusement in her tone now.
Who'd you think bankrolled that trip? Vacuum gear, drilling and construction equipment, the analog units, and the data processing system for the gate? Come on, Takashi. We were on the verge of a war. Where do you think all that stuff came from? Who do you think went in and wiped the gate from the landfall archive?
Like I said, I muttered. I didn't want to think about it. So, it was a Kempist gig. So why'd you waste them?
I don't know.
She gestured.
It seemed like... I don't know, Kovach.
Fair enough. I crushed out my cigarette, resisted the temptation to take another, then took it anyway. I watched her and waited.
It...
She stopped, shook her head, started again, enunciating with exasperated care.
I thought I was on their side. It made sense. We all agreed. In Kemp's hands, the ship would be a bargaining chip the cartel couldn't ignore. It could win the war for us, bloodlessly.
Uh-huh.
Then we found out it was a warship. Araboa found a weapons battery up near the prow. Pretty unmistakable. Then another one.
She stopped and sipped some water. Cleared her throat again.
They changed. Almost overnight, they all changed. Even Araboa, she used to be so... It was like possession. Like they'd been taken over by one of those sentiences you see in Xperia horror flicks. Like something had come through the gate and...
Another grimace.
I guess I never knew them all that well after all. The two on the trawler, they were cadres. I didn't know them at all. But they all went the same way. All talking about what could be done. The necessity of it. The revolutionary need. Vaporize landfall from orbit. Power up whatever drives the ship had. They were speculating FTL now. Talking about taking the war to Latimer. Doing the same thing there. Planetary bombardment. Latimer City, Poutasson, Soufriere. All gone like Sauberville. Until the Protectorate capitulated.
Could they have done that?
Maybe. The systems on Nakruma's land are pretty simple once you get to grips with the basics. If the ship was anything like...
She shrugged.
Which it wasn't. But we didn't know that then. They thought they could. That was what mattered. They didn't want a bargaining chip. They wanted a war machine. And I'd given it to them. They were cheering the death of millions as if it were a good joke. Getting drunk at night, talking it up. Singing fucking revolutionary songs, justifying it with rhetoric. All the shit you hear dripping off the government channels, twisted 180 degrees. Kant, political theory, all to shore up the use of a planetary massacre machine. And I'd given it to them. Without me, I don't think they could have gotten the gate open again. They were just scratchers. They needed me. They couldn't get anyone else. The guildmasters were all already on their way back to Latimer in cryocap liners, way ahead of the game, or holed up in landfall waiting for their guild-paid hypercast to come through. Wang and Araboa came looking for me in Indigo City. They begged me to help them, and I did.
There was something like a plea in her face as she turned to look at me.
I gave it to them.
But you took it away again, I said gently. Her hand groped across the table. I took it in mine and held it for a while. "Were you planning to do the same to us?" I asked, when she seemed to have calmed. She tried to withdraw her hand, but I held on to it. "It doesn't matter now," I said urgently. "These things are done. All you have to do now is live with them. That's how you do it, Tanya. Just admit it if it's true. To yourself, if not to me." A tear leaked out of the corner of one eye in the rigid face opposite me.
"I don't know,"
she whispered.
"I was just surviving."
"Good enough," I told her. We sat and held hands in silence until the waiter, on some aberrational whim, came to see if we wanted anything else. Later, on our way back down through the streets of Dig 27, we passed the same junk salvage yard and the same Martian artifact trapped in cement in the wall. An image erupted in my mind. The frozen agony of the Martians, sunk and sealed in the bubble stuff of their ship's hull. Thousands of them, extending to the dark horizon of the vessel's asteroidal bulk, a drowned nation of angels, beating their wings in a last insane attempt to escape whatever catastrophe had overwhelmed the ship in the throes of the engagement. I looked sideways at Tiny Wardani, and knew with a flash like an impotent rush that she was tuned to the same image.
"I hope he doesn't come here,"
she muttered. "Sorry?"
"Why, Sinsky, when the news breaks, he'll want to be here to see what we found. I think it might destroy him."
"Will they let him come?" She shrugged.
"Hard to really keep him out if he wants it badly enough. He's been pensioned off into sinecure research at Bradbury for the last century, but he still has a few silent friends in the Guild. There's enough residual awe for that. Enough guilt as well, the way he was treated. Someone'll turn the favor for him, blag him a hypercast, at least as far as Latimer. After that, well, he's still independently wealthy enough to make the rest of the running himself."
She shook her head.
"But it'll kill him. His precious Martians fighting and dying in cohorts just like humans. Mass graves and planetary wealth condensed into war machines. It tears down everything he wanted to believe about them."
"Well, predator stock."
"I know. Predators have to be smarter. Predators come to dominate. Predators evolve civilization and move out into the stars. That same old fucking song."
"Same old fucking universe," I pointed out gently.
"It's just..."
"At least they weren't fighting among themselves anymore. You said yourself the other ship wasn't Martian."
"Yeah, I don't know. It certainly didn't look it. But is that any better? Unify your race so you can go beat the shit out of someone else's? Couldn't they get past that?"
"Doesn't look like it." She wasn't listening. She stared blindly away at the cemented artifact.
"They must have known they were going to die. It would have been instinctive trying to fly away, like running from a bomb blast, like putting your hands out to stop a bullet."
"And then the hull, what, melted?" She shook her head again, slowly.
"I don't know. I don't think so. I've been thinking about this. The weapons we saw, they seem to be doing something more basic than that. Changing the..."
She gestured.
"I don't know, the wavelength of matter? Something hyperdimensional? Something outside 3D space? That's what it felt like. I think the hull disappeared. I think they were standing in space, still alive because the ship was still there in some sense, but knowing it was about to flip out of existence. I think that's when they tried to fly."
I shivered a little, remembering.
"It must have been a heavier attack than the one we saw,"
she went on.
"What we saw didn't come close."
I grunted.
"Yeah, well, the automated systems have had 100,000 years to work on it. Stands to reason they'd have it down to a fine art by now. Did you hear what Han said just before it got bad?"
"No."
"He said, this is what killed the others. The one we found in the corridors, but he meant the others, too. Weng, Araboa, the rest of the team. That's why they stayed out there until their air burned out. It happened to them, too, didn't it?" She stopped in the street to look at me.
"Look, if it did..."
I nodded. "Yeah, that's what I thought."
"We calculated that cometary, the glyph counters and our own instruments, just to be sure. Every 1,200 standard years, give or take. If this happened to Araboa's crew as well, it means..."
"It means another near-miss intersection with another warship. A year to 18 months back. And who knows what kind of orbit that might be locked into."
"Statistically..."
She breathed. "Yeah, you thought of that, too. Because statistically, the chances of two expeditions, 18 months apart, both having the bad luck to stumble on deep space cometary intersections like that?
Astronomical.
And that's being conservative. It's the next best thing to impossible.
Unless...
I nodded again and smiled because I could see the strength pouring back into her like current as she thought it through. That's right. Unless there's so much junk flying around out there that this is a very common occurrence. Unless, in other words, you're looking at the locked-in remains of an entire naval engagement on a system-wide scale.
We would have seen it,
she said uncertainly.
By now, we would have spotted some of them.
Doubtful. There's a lot of space out there, and even a 50-click hull is pretty small by asteroidal standards. And anyway, we haven't been looking. Ever since we got here, we've had our noses buried in the dirt, grubbing up quick-dig, quick-sale archaeological trash. Return on investment. That's the name of the game in Landfall. We've forgotten how to look any other way. She laughed, or something very like it.
You're not Wysinski, are you, Kovach? Because you talk just like him sometimes.
I built another smile. No, I'm not Wysinski either. The phone Ruespin Awegi had lent me thrummed in my pocket. I dug it out, wincing at the way my elbow joint grated on itself. Yeah?
Vong Savat, these guys are all done. We can be out of here by tonight. You want it that way?
I looked at Wardani and sighed. Yeah, I want it that way. Be down there with you in a couple of minutes. I pocketed the phone and started down the street again. Wardani followed.
Hey,
she said. Yeah?
That stuff about looking out, not grubbing in the dirt. Where did that come from all of a sudden, Mr. I'm not Wysinski?
I don't know. I shrugged. Maybe it's the Harlan's World thing. It's the one place in the Protectorate where you tend to look outward when you think about the Martians. Oh, we've got our own dig sites and remains, but the one thing about the Martians you don't forget is the orbitals. They're up there every day of your life, around and around, like angels with swords and twitchy fingers. Part of the night sky. This stuff, everything we found here, it doesn't really surprise me. It's about time.
Yes.
The energy I'd seen coming back to her was there in her tone, and I knew then that she'd be all right. There'd been a point when I thought that she wasn't staying for this, that anchoring herself here and waiting out the war was some obscure form of ongoing punishment she was visiting upon herself. But the bright edge of enthusiasm in her voice was enough. She'd be all right. It felt like the end of a long journey, a trip together that had started with a close contact of the envoy techniques for psychic repair in a stolen shuttle on the other side of the world. It felt like a scab coming off. One thing, I said, as we reached the street that wound down in dusty hairpins to Dig 27's shabby little landing field. Below us lay the dust-colored swirling of the Wedge battle wagon's camouflage cloaking field. We stopped again to look down at it.
Yeah?
What do you want me to do with your share of the money? She snorted a laugh, a real one this time.
Needle cast it to me. 11 years, right? Give me something to look forward to.
Right. Below, on the landing field, Amelie Vong Savath emerged abruptly from the cloaking field and stood looking up at us with one hand shading her eyes. I lifted an arm and waved, then started down toward the battle wagon and the long ride out. Epilogue. The Anjan Chandra's virtue blasts her way up off the plane of the ecliptic and out into deep space. She's already moving faster than most humans can clearly visualize, but even that's pretty slow by interstellar standards. At full acceleration, she'll still only ever get up to a fraction of the near light speeds the colony barges managed coming the other way a century ago. She's not a deep space vessel. She's not built for it. But her guidance systems are new and Ovic, and she'll get where she's going in her own time. Here in the virtuality, you tend to lose track of external context. Ruespin Awegi's contractors have done us proud. There's a shoreline in wind and wave-gnawed limestone, slumped down to the water's edge like the layers of melted wax at the base of a candle. The terraces are sun-blasted a white so intense it hurts to look at without lenses, and the sea is dappled to brilliance. You can step off the limestone, straight into 5 meters of crystal clear water, and a cool that strips the sweat off your skin like old clothes. There are multicolored fish down there.